So today's topic is artistic interpretation or interpretation in art. And as usual, I'll make some connection with the preceding lecture, though it'll be pretty slim. The preceding lecture was, artistic expression. And a connection... of this sort at least can be offered, that one of the things that might be involved in interpreting an artwork is figuring out what it expresses. And why is that the case? Because of what interpretation means, and probably the most useful overall notion of interpretation is something like finding or discovering or attributing or assigning some kind of meaning or significance or content, and what a work of art expresses, typically emotions, moods, feelings, is part of what it's about, part of what it means. So when we were talking about theories of expression, we were indirectly talking about interpretation, interpreting works of art from the point of view of what they might convey or reveal about, say, the emotional domain. So now let's just think about interpretation more directly. And before we think about artistic interpretation, let's think about interpretation in general. Interpretation is a very big subject. It's sometimes said to be the basic subject or the basic method of the human sciences or the social sciences. And there is a word I'm sure you've heard, which basically means the theory of interpretation, which is a sort of field or a way of doing the human sciences called hermeneutics. So we can't hope to cover everything there is to say about interpretation, but we can say a few things that are at least helpful on the general level, and then move to what interpretation in art specifically involves and what questions philosophers have been concerned with about artistic interpretation. So the basic notion of interpretation. Well, as I've already said, one kind of useful gloss is that it's the attempt to assign or discern or attribute meaning or significance to something. So the connection between interpretation and meaning is a pretty tight one. I think no one would suggest that interpretation can be severed from the idea of meaning, or at least something like meaning. I'll suggest some other things that are like meaning, but not exactly meaning a little later. But every time we grasp a meaning, are we interpreting? That's the other side of the coin. Interpretation, let's take it, must involve some kind of an attempt to attribute meaning. But is every time we perceive meaning a case of interpretation? Most theorists have thought that that's not a useful way to go, because some occasions or some contexts where we understand the meaning are too direct or too immediate to count as interpretation. So when I say close the door, you understand what I mean. You grasp my meaning. But it'd be odd to say that you interpreted my words. If I said them in French, maybe it would make some sense to say you were trying to interpret my words, especially if your French isn't too good. But assuming they were the words in English that we all understand, really without thinking about it or being aware that we're thinking about it, seems odd to say that we're interpreting. So another idea that's pretty common is that interpretation not only involves trying to ascribe or figure out a meaning for something, but that it has to be somewhat non-obvious. It has to be something that takes some kind of effort or work. If it happens automatically that you grasp a meaning, then it doesn't seem useful to call that interpretation. So what kind of work does interpreting involve? Well, here, this brings us to a third feature you might say is at least distinctive interpretation, if not found in every case. It involves thinking or inference. You sort of try out possibilities. You offer conjectures, or you float hypotheses. You may do this semi-consciously, and it may be very quick in many cases, but it's that kind of activity whereby you don't immediately see, without thinking about it, what something means, or is about, or conveys, or expresses, and you think of possibilities, you float possibilities that that might help you get at what it means. A lot of interpretation, although I would claim not all of it, seems to be involved in trying to figure out people's intentions. So a lot of interpretation is aimed at figuring out intentions, because those aren't immediately obvious. They're not like the color of someone's shirt or, you know, the meaning of a simple declarative sentence in one's native language. They are, you know, they're sort of mental or hidden or obscure in some cases. And so a lot of interpretation seems aimed at figuring out intent. But that, unlike, say, the first three features I mentioned, interpretation connects to meaning, interpretation involves something that's not obvious or immediately apparent, and interpretation involves thinking or conjecturing or hypothesizing. This connection is typical, but it's hardly definitive, because there are clearly things that we interpret where intent is not in question, is not in the situation. You might find a pattern of sand on the beach, or a set of stones that are interestingly arrayed in a clearing in a forest, and you might try to interpret that. But you wouldn't necessarily assume that there was any intentional action behind it or that there was any intent for the arrangement, but you might think the arrangement somehow meant something or signified something. Why? Well, you mean you could be of a... You might be of a kind of magical or mystical frame of mind and think that, you know, everything is a sign of something or other in the cosmic order. Or you might be of just a scientific frame of mind and think that this particular constellation of sand or stones indicates something about some preceding natural phenomenon or preceding state of the environment you're looking at. So you're interpreting what you're looking at as an indication of some other kind of natural process. So neither in those two cases, it's not clear that it seems that you're not aiming at establishing intent, because it doesn't seem like there's any intentional action behind the thing that you're interpreting, and yet it's still something that you might say you could interpret. Here's a somewhat broader notion about intent interpretation, so this is under the rubric of seeing interpretation as aimed at meaning or something like meaning. One thing that interpretation might aim at is making sense of a phenomenon, making sense of a situation. And that isn't necessarily coming up with the meaning of the situation, but sort of figuring out how the situation works or how it's put together or what its basic structure or form is. And that leads to, say, another idea that you can connect to interpretation that's sort of broader and looser than the idea of assigning meaning. It's figuring out a way to look at or approach or view or regard something. That might count as an activity of interpretation. And clearly that has direct application to some of the things that concern us about art. Not always what does it mean, but how am I supposed to kind of take it or look at it or, you know, perceive it. Let that then serve for some sort of pointers about the general idea of interpretation. It connects to meaning or something like it. The meaning has to be a not obvious or immediately apparent one. It involves sort of thinking or hypothesizing. And it sometimes involves figuring out intent, but not in every case. And some of these sort of broader things interpretation might aim at, if not literally meaning or content, would be making sense of a phenomenon or a situation, or figuring out a way to approach or take or view the situation. That might count as interpretive work. Nothing we can say on the general wavelength is to think about what kinds of things are interpreted. Since we think about the full range of things that are interpreted, that'll help us to see exactly how broad the notion of interpretation is, since it really takes such a wide range of things. So here are some of the things that are interpreted: persons, actions, gestures, utterances, natural objects, like in my example of the bits of sand or stone in the forest, artworks, we're going to get to that very soon, instrument results. What I mean by instrument results. The things that turn up when you take an MRI or an X-ray or do a chromatograph or other kind of analysis in the chem lab. You get these kind of printouts or displays or pieces of paper, and they need interpreting. And when they're rightly interpreted, they tell you, you know, whether someone has a certain disease or whether a certain liquid contained potassium or not. Here's an even broader list. I once wrote an article on the general idea of interpretation, and I had fun just sort of making up a big list sort of at random, so I'll read from some of it. These are some of the things that you can interpret, and in the sense that I'm calling, that we can label semantic interpreting, interpreting for meaning or content or significance. Later in the talk, I'll mention other kinds of interpreting that are not what I've been talking about so far, the attribution of meaning, sense, significance, or something like that. There's other kinds of interpreting, so let me mention what it is, because I'll get back to it later. For example, the kind of interpreting that people who play musical instruments do. That's called interpreting. You know, the pianist interprets the piano sonata. The dancer interprets a dance. The actor interprets the role of Iago. This is not the same thing, but we'll get back to what it is eventually, and see whether, in fact, what the connection might be, if any, between interpreting in the sense we're mainly concerned with, and which I just a minute ago labeled semantic interpreting, attributing sense or meaning, and interpreting in that other sense. But since I mentioned it, let me give you a label for that other sense. Call it performative interpreting. So my list is just a list of things that are semantically interpretable. A person's facial expression, a person's gesture or bearing, a person's action, a rock in the desert, tea leaves at the bottom of one's cup, lines on the palm of one's hand, an ambiguous phrase or sentence, an ambiguous visual figure like the duck rabbit, a situation, say there's a swinging door, what does that mean? Who just left the saloon. I've just seen one of Clint Eastwood's earliest movies, and also I just saw his most recent movie, which is in the cinema, and that made a very interesting comparison. I'm talking about High Plains Drifter and Gran Torino, which I recommend, by the way. It's not at all a fascist movie. So a swinging door, what does that mean? A missing car, what does that mean? An official act, for example, an embassy closing, what does that mean? A medical symptom, an X-ray, a Rorschach blot. Rorschach blots are nice examples since they are, you know, they're things that are made to be interpreted and yet to be inscrutable in a way. One of my colleagues, teaches at York, once commented on this, that example that, I can't explain what that is just because I haven't introduced another distinction. Okay, I'm going to continue to read some more things from this list, but this list is partly to illustrate a distinction between two kinds of general interpretation, one of which you can call does-mean interpretation or determinative interpretation, and the other which you can call could-mean interpretation or exploratory interpretation. In the first mode, these are kinds or modes of interpretation. In the first mode, you're trying to figure out what something actually does mean. In the other mode, you're not trying to figure out what something does mean, but merely kind of running through possibilities of what it could mean. Now, clearly, in doing the former, you might always be doing the latter. That is, the latter might be a heuristic for doing the former. But sometimes you could just do the latter. What could it mean without having any intent or any aim to actually arrive at what it does mean? Okay, now I can go back to my example. The Rorschach blot looks like a clear example of something that has been devised for playing the what could it mean game, for engaging in what could it mean activity, interpretive activity. And that's, in fact, the way it does seem to me. That's what they're for. But my colleague pointed out that, well, it's used as a diagnostic tool, so in fact, isn't it the case that when the Rorschach blots are interpreted, that you try to figure out what it does mean for a given subject? And that's true, but notice that what I said and what my colleagues said are not really in conflict. The Rorschach blots per se, apart from their being responded to by a particular patient, are, as I'm claiming, things that could mean this, could mean that, could mean something else, and that do not mean anything particular. On the other hand, if you consider the responses of a particular patient to the Rorschach blot, what do you see here? Well, I see my uncle devouring a giant insect. Okay, then it does mean something. First of all, it means literally what he said, and second, maybe it means something in terms of his underlying psychology or maybe psychopathology. So the Rorschach blots, I would continue to hold, are a prime example of the sort of thing to which we apply what could it mean, interpretive activity, whereas a particular result, a response to a Rorschach blot by a patient is something to which, well, you could also apply what could it mean thinking, but the aim would probably be to figure out what it does mean, because the Rorschach blots are supposed to be used in that way in a diagnostic context. Okay, just a few more examples. Literary works. So they're things that we love to interpret and which are perhaps made partly so as to give us exercise in interpreting. The starry heavens, something that Kant liked to think about. Readings and measurements, jokes and witticisms, a stain on the sidewalk, an unexpected natural event, movement on the stock exchange, deliverances of an oracle, a chess move of one's opponent, a crossword puzzle clue, passages in the Bible. So, the range of things that are interpreted is very great. Well, what does that show? Only that meaning is everywhere, or at least the attempt to find meaning is pretty widespread. We are kind of meaning-seeking and meaning-making creatures. Let me say a few words about the distinction I mentioned a minute ago between semantic interpreting, that'll be our main focus for the rest of the talk, and performative interpreting. The latter is crucial in the performing arts, in music, in theater, in dance, and in, say, poetry considered as a performing art. Whereas the former, semantic interpreting, which you might call construing, seems crucial in the arts that have a more obvious content, let's say, particularly arts that involve articulate words, so the arts of literature and film. We'd like to figure out what novels mean, what written poems mean, what films mean. Now, some people balk immediately and they say, oh, that's not the right way to go about this. That's not what those artworks are about. It's absurd to talk about the meaning of a novel or a poem or a film. Of course, it's absurd to talk about it if you think that it can be expressed in like a sentence, or even that it can be fully expressed in any number of sentences. But it's also a mistake, it seems to me, to think that you can't talk about the meaning of a complex work at all, work of art at all. It seems to me that when we do have good, insightful interpretations of works of art, these are, if they are semantic interpretations, or use a somewhat broader label, critical interpretations, they're going to be expressed in language normally. And good ones will capture, will express, will convey some of what works mean. It's only a kind of pernicious or a misleading goal if you think that all of what works mean can be put into words, even when those artworks are made of words. That doesn't change the fact. A poem is made of words, but it doesn't mean that its meaning is entirely explicable in words. But the idea that none of its meaning is explicable in words, or none of the meaning of a novel or a film is explicable or capturable in words, is also seems to be unjustified. So let's move then now to think about interpretation in art, focusing primarily on what I'm calling semantic interpretation, trying to ascribe an articulable meaning to an artwork. Well, why would one want to do that? Sometimes questions seem they seem to be a little too sort of like the questions that you end up with when your child keeps asking, well, why this, well, why that, and then finally it's you just say, well, no, that's why. It's obvious. There's nothing more to say. Maybe this one I shouldn't have started here because, well, why do you want to interpret works? Why do you want to figure out what they mean? Well, that's because really it's basic to the point of artworks as some kind of mode of communication or expression. What else do we want to do with them? I mean, there are other things we want to do with them and we want from them, such as to have pleasurable experiences, but if they have a meaning or a content, we'd like to figure out what it is. So, maybe we don't need to dwell on why it is we want to interpret artworks. What are the criteria of succeeding? What are the criteria of succeeding in interpreting artworks? Well, again, you can give a kind of flat answer, but it's not clear how much illumination that affords. Well, the goal is to actually figure out what they do mean. Well, how do you do that? And what is the meaning of a novel or a film or a poem? Is it like the meaning of a sentence? Well, let me postpone that question. I think I've dug myself into a hole here. I'm not sure how to get out of it. So let me move to something simpler, the relationship between interpreting, understanding, and evaluating. That'll perhaps shed some light on our question. Can you understand a work without interpreting it? Well, not if it's a work that has a meaning. Maybe some artworks can be understood in a purely perceptual way. That is, say, if you perceive them with a certain kind of unity, or if you follow them, say, a piece of music or a dance with a certain kind of coherence, that might count as understanding and you don't have to interpret them. But insofar as an artwork does have something like a meaning, it looks as if you have to try and get that meaning or significance right, otherwise you couldn't count as understanding it. So to take the two prime examples of the semantic interpreting we're trying to get some kind of handle on, novels and films, is it enough to understand the novel that you can kind of read each sentence, understand what each sentence says, and sort of move along in a continuous way from beginning to end? It doesn't seem as if that's enough. Is it enough to understand the film that you kind of take in what each shot or each sequence represents visually, and leave aside the soundtrack, and keep your attention focused on the screen from beginning to end? And no popcorn breaks. Is that enough to understand the film? No. Why? It's because films generally are about something. They convey a story. They convey a kind of perspective. Novels are about something. They tell stories, but they also sort of suggest views of human life. And unless you get a handle on those things, you don't quite understand them. So it's not enough to merely, let's call it, perceptually process a novel or a film in a coherent, continuous way for that to count as understanding it. Perhaps, I don't actually believe this, but at least the contrast is somewhat plausible. Perhaps a piece of music, that's enough for understanding, that you just kind of follow it from beginning to end, and it makes sense, and your ear kind of goes along with it in a way that gives you a certain kind of interesting set of sensations and more or less pleasure. But that's because on the assumption that maybe music doesn't really mean anything. So it's enough to understand music that you're able to perceptually track it or follow it. No one would hold, I don't believe that view. I do think that music has certain meaning or content, and thus you do have to do more than merely follow it. But when you move to novel or film, no one would hold the view that understanding just involves sort of perceptually processing it from beginning to end with a certain kind of, focused attention. Since it's obvious that novels and films have something like meaning. So, in short, for those art forms at least, and probably for almost all art forms, or maybe all art forms, understanding requires interpreting at some level. And if there is such a thing, interpreting correctly. If you understand if you want to understand an artwork, it's not enough to have a view of its meaning or content. Presumably it should be the right view, or a view that's, you know, acceptable or justifiable. And finally, the connection with evaluation is obvious too, but we can, you know, just dot the I on that. You can't evaluate a work properly, can't say how valuable it is, something I'll talk about tomorrow, unless you are understanding it. And since most cases of understanding, or maybe all cases of understanding art, involve interpreting at some level, without interpreting it. So that's a you know, kind of connection between evaluating, interpreting, and understanding. Not a very profound one. Okay, let's move then to the issue of what our goals might be in interpreting a work of art. Semantically, figuring out what it means. Well, the goal might be just that, figuring out what the work means. And in fact, that's the view I would defend. But some theorists think that, well, that may be true, but that the focus needs to be put elsewhere. They would say, some of the other theorists, that the goal is to figure out what the artist meant by the work or in the work. So what we're really after is figuring out what artists mean. And usually I'm talking about, for the purposes of this discussion, I'll mainly be talking about literary work. So when I say artist, you can substitute usually author. So on this second perspective, the goal of semantically interpreting art is to figure out what the artist meant by or in the work, or by producing the work. Another angle is that it's not so much what the work really does mean, so because you doubt whether that's a solid fact, or figuring out what the artist meant by the work, but figuring out an ascription of meaning to the work that seems most satisfying, or that seems to give most pleasure, or that seems to make for a most rewarding experience. Okay, I was very loosely put, but you'll see in the views I'm going to contrast shortly about interpretation. You'll see hints of those, you know, three ideas. Which again, I let me recap in another way, equally loose. It's kind of a work focused idea, an artist focused idea, and a kind of aesthetic appreciation optimization focused idea. Okay, here's an issue I'm sure you've heard about in regard to interpretation, namely whether one should be a pluralist or a monist about interpretation. To be a pluralist about interpretation is to say, well, interpretation is a subtle, complicated matter, and artworks are usually kind of rich and to some extent, you know, ambiguous and suggestive. And so the normal or default case is that an artwork will have many equally good or acceptable interpretations. That's to say, many equally good or acceptable attributions or proposals for what the work, you know, means or says or is about or conveys. And a monist will say, no, there's always a single best interpretation of a work. Okay, this latter view sits well with one of the strands in contemporary theory of interpretation that I'm going to talk about in a minute, which I'll label actual intentionalism or author intentionalism, which is roughly the idea that what works mean is what their authors, their artists, their creators, you know, intended them to mean, with some other conditions, when some other conditions are fulfilled at least. And usually that's a pretty unitary thing. Authors usually have a particular thing they're trying to convey, or at least in many cases they will. And So that the right interpretation, or the best interpretation, one thing that bedevils this kind of topic is that people shift around a lot between true, best, correct, acceptable, admissible, and it's not clear whether they're always talking. It's always the same question. But and I'll do that as well. I can't sort that out, I think, very well at the moment. So I also shift around among those different words by which we convey or express that we like, or that we think a certain interpretation is valuable or good or right or something. Okay, so if you take the view that what a artwork means has got some very close connection with what its maker intended it to mean, then you're likely to be a monist. You're likely to think, yeah, there's always one right interpretation. It's the one that accords with the artist's intention. But I want to make it clear that there is no necessary connection between monism and being an author intentionalist. You might be a monist for other reasons. You might think that it always just works out that there is one best interpretation, but not because that interpretation is the one that corresponds to the author's actual intention. You might have other reasons for thinking it always does point to one best interpretation, but not because that corresponds to the author's intention. Well, that's a very kind of... that's a bit hard to grasp in the abstract, so let me fill it in by giving you more or less the view that I hold, which is a kind of monism, but it's not a monism that derives from author intentionalism, since I tend not to think that author intentionalism is the right way to think about interpretation. So what do I mean by enlightened monism? Okay, something like this, that if at a first level one's a pluralist, one has the view that for a complex or an enigmatic work of art, like, say, Kafka's The Castle, a long, somewhat unfinished novel that makes it particularly hard to interpret as well, but even if it were finished, it would be long, enigmatic and suggestive. When you have a view like that, you might have a number of individual interpretations that are compelling and that are good in terms of the sense that they make of the work and in terms of, here I'm looking ahead towards another view that I'm going to defend, in terms of a kind of plausible attribution of intention to Kafka. But they are, at least on the surface, incompatible. So there is a kind of bureaucratic interpretation of The Castle. There's a religious interpretation of The Castle. There's a psychoanalytic interpretation of The Castle. Maybe there's something you might call a kind of purely sort of metaphysical interpretation of The Castle. Has anyone here read The Castle? Okay, good. That's the kind of student I like to have in class. Anyway, believe me, it's an enigmatic, peculiar novel that is worth reading and interpreting. So there are these number of individually different... how many of you have read The Metamorphosis? Okay, you could just substitute that example in your mind, although that one isn't quite, I think, as susceptible to multiple perspectives or readings as The Castle. But so take any of those enigmatic works of Kafka. There might be a number of individual interpretations that are good by criteria that I'm going to elaborate in a minute. Roughly connected to being plausibly attributed to the author and making some sense of the work as a whole, and perhaps giving you a rewarding experience of the narrative when viewed under that rubric, but that they're different. One of them sees The Castle in terms of a kind of critique of bureaucratic pressures. Another sees it in terms of a kind of hopeless, because never fulfillable, search for religious salvation. Another sees it in terms of a nexus of psychological complexes in a given individual of a familial and sexual sort. There's a scene in the Castle, for example, which is very, very much like a return to the womb by the main character, whose name is Kay, I guess. In miscarriage of a kind of powerful lord who visits the castle on a mission. In any case, these interpretations are different, and they seem like competing interpretations. So that would seem to leave you with pluralism. But when you ask yourself, well, how is this work correctly interpreted? And you ask yourself, well, are any of these interpretations to be rejected? And you say no. On the other hand, there are some interpretations you would reject. So maybe the castle is a critique of 21st century ecological water reduction practices. It's just not. It couldn't possibly be that for various reasons. But that's the reason so obvious why it couldn't be that. But you can also think of readings that just wouldn't make any sense, even if they weren't so obviously anachronistic readings of the castle. So you have a number of interpretations that are in some way compelling, and you don't want to reject any of them. So if you ask yourself, well, how is the castle to be interpreted? The right answer is something like, well, it's to be seen, or it's to be seen as seeable in way A, B, C, and D, where A, B, C, and D are individually acceptable, coherent, sense-making, plausibly ascribable to an author like Kafka interpretations. But that means that, in effect, there is one right interpretation or one best interpretation. It's something like the ensemble of the individually correct interpretations, which are not, of course, to be thought of as holding simultaneously, or you're not supposed to conjoin them, but you're supposed to understand that that is the ensemble of views that make sense to see the castle in terms of. So that's what I mean by enlightened monism, that there is really one correct interpretation, but it's not an interpretation with a small I, it's a kind of global interpretation, which is the ensemble of all the individually acceptable interpretations. Okay, that's a kind of monism, even though its heart is sort of pluralist. But that's not a kind of monism that is anyway beholden to or deriving from author intentionalism. Okay, so now let's talk about author intentionalism, and then I'll talk about competing view, which is called hypothetical intentionalism, which I tend to favor and doggedly try to defend against very clever actual intentionalists, such as our own Hans Mees here, and Paisley Livingston, Robert Stecker, and other current theorists who are of this persuasion. Noel Tarot, somewhat, as well. But before I talk about those two views, there are, of course, other views in the landscape of interpretive theory. I'm not really talking about them. One view, I guess maybe nobody holds, is let's stay with literary works for simplicity. A literary work means, whatever meaning could be ascribed to its text. So it's to say that if you take the text and whatever meaning can be imposed on it is what the literary work means. This view is just much, much too liberal, it seems to me. And it doesn't give any weight to the idea that the text is actually an instrument or a tool in a communicative or expressive act by a particular historically, culturally situated individual. When we interpret literary works, we're not just interpreting texts in the abstract. So, for example, if you had something like, some people talk about this kind of example in these discussions, if you had, say, a computer program that generated poems by kind of randomly throwing words together, that might be the kind of thing that you would interpret that way. But that wouldn't be an artwork. That would be a text, but the text wouldn't have any context. It wouldn't have any role in a communicative, expressive activity. And so there really isn't a work there at all. Some of you might remember, I think I mentioned this story, The Library of Babel by Borges in one of the earlier lectures. How many people know that story? Did I mention it? Anyway, it's a story about a kind of infinite library that has all the books in the world, all the books possible. But as a matter of fact, this is how I like to interpret. So notice you have to interpret things even to talk about interpretation. The way I interpret this story, it's about the worst library in the world. It has no books in it whatsoever. It has all possible books, but it has no actual books. Because an actual book is the use of a particular text by a kind of a sentient agent in order to express or convey something. A text per se, you know, a set of words in a language is not a book. And all you have in the Library of Babel are these pseudo-books, just texts that don't have any context to anchor them in any kind of communicative act and thus don't mean anything. Here I usually, when I bring up this example, I like to assure people that at whatever institution of higher learning they're at, they have a pretty good library compared to the Library of Babel. Your library here at Kent, which I only stepped into once, this is, you know, the post-book age, is a great library compared to the Library of Babel. It's much better. The Library of Babel is totally worthless because it doesn't consist of books. It consists of just texts without any tethering to any kind of context, and thus they have no meaning. All right, so there might be some folk out there who would take it that a literary work just means what its text could be made to mean under no constraints whatsoever, but I think that's a very rare view. So I'll leave that aside. And just come back to the two views that I will discuss. Actual intentionalism and hypothetical intentionalism. Okay, what does an actual intentionalist say about the meaning of literary work? Well, let's take first the extreme view. The extreme form of actual or author intentionalism is that the meaning of the work is just identical to the author's intended meaning. There's just a complete identity there. Whatever the author intended the work to mean, that's what the work means. Here a quote from a commentator on this view. This is Greg Curry commenting on this view, though not defending it. On this view, interpretation is constrained by the requirement that it correspond, that interpretation correspond to what the author in fact intended to mean. Okay, that's not true. Very few people actually hold this view. There were two theorists, three theorists, there's a couple and then a single guy, who held a view very close to this in the literature in the past 30 years. One is a guy named Peter Yule, I think his name is, J-U-H-L. And then another better known defender of this view was a pair called Knapp and Michaels. I've forgotten their first names. And there are even hints of this in the best-known actual intentionalists, at least from an earlier generation, E.D. Hirsch. But Knapp and Michaels really are the ones who defend the most extreme form of this. And almost nobody really holds this view because it's so extreme. It just doesn't put any success conditions on the idea of having an intention for work to mean something. Surely a literary can't mean whatever you intend it to mean, regardless of how the literary work turns out, regardless of what its text seems to be, regardless of how it's plausible to understand it. The problem here is related to points that it's sometimes made about what's called the Humpty Dumpty view of meaning. So just making words mean whatever you want. So can you mean Mercury is the planet closest to the sun by saying, it's a nice day out, isn't it? So if I really try, can I mean that fact about Mercury by, using the words, it's a nice day out, isn't it? No, you can't do that. You can't use those words to mean that. You might be able to mean what I said by using somewhat different words, and maybe you could even mean it by enacting something visually. Maybe there could be a dance way of representing that fact. But you certainly can't mean it by using that other sentence that I offered. can't just mean make any old sentence mean whatever you want. So no one really holds extreme author intentionalism. So let's move to a moderate form. The moderate form is complicated and has lots of variants. Again, I think that the two most sophisticated current defenders of a moderate kind of author intentionalism are the two I mentioned before, Paisley Livingston and Robert Stecker. Maybe Noel Carroll would count as well. And there the idea is that the author's intended meaning, what the author intends to mean, is part of what determines meaning. So the work meaning is partly determined by, is partly a function of what the author intended to mean. But only when, as it were, the text somehow reflects that adequately. Or, to use a phrase that the author intentionalists tend to lean on, but which I'm deeply suspicious of, when the intention is successfully realized in the work. And one thing that allows the intention to be successfully realized in the work is that there are certain conventions of language maybe playing a role, and certain features of the communicative context may play a role in realizing the intention. But that the actual intention of the author to mean something is going to play a role as well. And that we'll have to be careful. Both because it's a complicated view and because different theorists finesse it differently. But I think this is, say, Stecker's version, that a work meaning is in most cases partly a function of the author's actual intention to mean such and such. But conventions and context will play a role in realizing the intention. But, and this is part of the complexity of the view, in some cases, where there is no intention, the artist's intention was unformed or is ambiguous or unclear, then it could be that the meaning is established just by the conventions of language and by the features of the communicative context. And, of course, what the text offers as a basis. Or before I say something about what are the pros and cons of this view, let me make a simpler point I forgot to make, which is that almost no theorist is going to be willing to equate the meaning of a work with its text. And that's true of not just of literary works, that's true of almost all uses of language. Almost all uses of language involve meaning that goes beyond the meaning of the text, meaning that goes beyond the literal meaning of the words that are used. And I'm talking about very ordinary contexts, not just literary contexts. With literary works, the meaning of the work goes well beyond and may even contradict the text meaning, as when texts are used metaphorically or symbolically or ironically. But we can have simple examples of that just from ordinary discourse. Well, I'll start with this one. That's a pretty common sort of example. So when someone says, can you pass the salt? Okay, literally, that's asking whether you have a certain ability. And if you're not, paralyzed or, hyper-drugged, then probably the answer is yes. Okay, but that's not all that means. When someone says, can you pass the salt at a dinner table? Usually they're asking you to pass the salt. They're expressing their desire that you pass the salt. But they didn't say, please pass the salt, and they didn't say, I desire that you pass the salt. They just said, can you pass the salt? So what was meant by that active language goes beyond the text, per se, the literal meaning of the text, which is literally just an inquiry about whether you have a certain ability. Um, Or here's an example that's used in this literature. What I'm talking about now is sort of the pragmatic aspect of communication through language and how much is conveyed by the pragmatic features of the situation, of the context, and that isn't contained in the literal meaning of the sentences, the verbal vehicle that's employed. There's an example about someone who writes a reference letter for some student and says something like, prominently says something like, he has very nice penmanship. Okay, well, okay, that may be true. Maybe he does have very nice penmanship. But by writing that in a reference letter, you're probably conveying that the student is not all that talented for the academic purposes that the letter is being written. There's an example that's related to that, one of my favorite scenes in a movie. It's the movie version of Washington Square, the Henry James novella. And the movie version is called, does anybody know? It's called The Heiress. Really, really great. Sentimental, but great movie. And there's a point when it mainly involves a conflict between a father and his daughter, in which he has sort of always been disappointed. And at the end of sort of an attempt to wean her from her bad ways and her unfortunate alliance with a kind of probably Goldenian character, he says something like, "And you embroider neatly." It's like the only thing you can think of to say about her that's positive. Well, yes, it's maybe the case that she embroiders neatly, but by saying that and almost nothing else, he conveys how a low opinion he has for it. So he's one of the great cruel fathers in literature. I try to think about him sometimes when I think I'm maybe guilty of that kind of attitude. Okay, so in almost every use of language, there's a lot that's conveyed that's not conveyed or contained in the literal meaning of the text. Okay, well, this is a point that seems to favor actual intentionalism or author intentionalism. It looks like that if we don't ascertain the actual intention with which a text is written or spoken or offered, then it's going to be indeterminate whether the work involves irony, whether it involves allusion, parody, satire, symbolism, and so on. So, in seeking to interpret a literary artwork, it looks like we must always aim at uncovering a plausible intention of the actual artist, a plausible intention with which the text is being put forward. Okay, but here's a point in which this view and the competing view are completely in accord. Namely, that when we're trying to understand the meaning of a literary work, which is, you know, embodied in or in a particular text, a particular textual vehicle, we have to figure out a likely intention for what this text is about, what this text is trying to say, what this text is conveying. We need to come up with a plausible intention that with which the text is projected. Is it projected straight? Is it projected symbolically? Is it projected ironically, metaphorically, tongue-in-cheek, with an eye to, you know, evoking really sentimental sorts of reactions, or with an idea to invoking a comic reaction because its sentimentality is too over the top. I'm not thinking of the example that a lot of people talk about, the example of the death of little Nell in the old Curiosity Shop. Is that the novel? How did Dickens mean this? Well, I take it to the most plausible understanding of the passage is that Dickens meant you to be affected by this touching episode in a kind of heartfelt sort of sentimental way. Oscar Wilde famously said that you have to have, a heart of stone not to laugh at the death of little Nell. Oscar Wilde wasn't buying it. But I think even Oscar Wilde wouldn't have thought that Dickens really meant you to have the second order, you know, amused comical reaction at the overblown attempt to induce a sentimental sympathy for little Nell. So in any case, when we interpret literary works, we have to be engaged with figuring out a plausible intention with which the text has been projected. But here's where this other view starts to look like a competitor and is in complete agreement with the author intentionalism on this point. This other view is what I call hypothetical intentionalism. And a basic premise of that view is a distinction that I'll elaborate in a minute between utterer's meaning and utterance meaning. The utterer is the speaker or the writer, and the utterance is what's done or offered in virtue of what's spoken or written. So what is the utterer's meaning? It's what a speaker or writer means by his utterance. It's what the agent means, you know, what the agent has in mind, what the agent's trying to convey, something like that. But what is the utterance meaning? Let's say, what is the utterance made by the speaker, whatever the speaker has in mind, in that context, by using that vehicle? What is the utterance meaning? What is the meaning of the utterance? Is it always the same as what the utterer meant? And the answer seems to be no. Utterance meaning is something else. It's something like this. It's what an audience would most reasonably take a speaker or writer to mean by the utterance, in the given context of utterance. What the audience would most reasonably take the speaker or writer to mean by his or her utterance in that context. So, for example, again, a very simple example from ordinary conversation. A person who utters, "Splendid day, isn't it?" when unbeknownst to him, a storm has begun, but, and everyone else is aware of this, but he hasn't looked out the window lately. Well, what he meant as an utterer, as an agent, is that it was a fine day. But in that context, it looks like what he said would be taken ironically. It looks like in that context, it would be taken that his utterance meant it's a nasty day. Why? Because it's most natural to take the utterer's remark as ironic in that context of utterance. Unless, you know, people had noticed that he hadn't noticed that it was now a nasty day. I thought at this point I'd mention a real complicated example from that happened to... happened to be central to the novel that I just finished reading, and which I also highly recommend, a novel called The Human Stain by Philip Roth. Now, in this novel, which is about a college professors love novels about college professors, but it is actually a very good novel. I'd say it's the best novel I've written. I know I made that slip. I sometimes think about writers that I like, and I think, well, you know, if I worked harder, if I... a little more imaginative life, yeah, I could kind of write that. It's not so far from me culturally and psychologically, and that's what I do think that about Philip Roth. But for another, you know, also great writer, like Ian McEwan, when I read one of his novels and I'm blown away by it, I never have that thought. I never think, gee, I could have written that. So Philip Roth, you know, in a possible world not too far from this one, I could have written his novels, but I could never have written Ian McEwan's better novels. That's why I made that slip. Anyway, so what was I saying? Yes, I think it's the best novel by Philip Roth that I've read. Right. So what's the example? The example is this college professor, and one day he's sort of taking role in class, and there are a couple of students on his roster who just never turn up. So he says... I don't think he uses their name. Maybe he uses their name. He says, these two students, do these... Let me get this right, actually. What does he say exactly? He wrote this down somewhere. Exact words matter here. Do these two students exist, or are they just spooks? So the utterer's meaning is, are these students actually in the class? That's what professors... mean when they say things like that. But obviously he used somewhat unusual words there, And as it turns out, maybe some of you don't know this, that spook is a somewhat outmoded, somewhat derogatory term for a black person. And it turns out that the two students who were not showing up were black. And when they heard about this remark in class, they kind of lodged a complaint on the grounds of racism against the professor, and eventually he would have to resign. He didn't exactly have to resign, but there was enough of a stink that one way or another, the upshot was that he decided to resign. All right, how does this relate to my distinction here? The utterer's meaning here, you know, what he meant to convey, what he intended to mean is, are these students really in the class? And what he meant by using that word spook is just, you know, it's sort of literal meaning, you know, a specter, a ghost, something that has some nominal existence but isn't really there. The way the remark was heard by, well, this is not a pure example of what I want to illustrate, but it's a good example of it to illustrate the complexity of this issue. So let me try and put this carefully. I want to now move to say what the utterance meaning of his remark is, but that's not so easy to pin down. But we can at least say this. It's not clear what the utterance meaning is of his remark. That is to say, it's not clear what the most reasonable imputation to him as an intended meaning is in that context. But it might very well not be what he meant to say. It might be that to that class, with a certain kind of kind of racial sensitivity, this is said in something like the late 80s, early 90s, one might reasonably have thought that by saying that, the professor was alluding to the race of the students, and maybe even suggesting that, well, you know, if they are black, then of course, you know, you can't expect them to show up for class, or something really pernicious like that. It might be that that would be slightly plausible thing to attribute to the speaker in that context. As a matter of fact, I don't think that is. But all I'm trying to do is establish a theoretical point that what that statement meant in context isn't necessarily the same as what the speaker meant to convey, because of features of the situation that make it plausible to ascribe a certain intention to the speaker, even though the speaker doesn't in fact have that intention. How many of you have read this novel? I don't know whether to tell you more about it and spoil it for you. But what's interesting is that the novel is about, not just about the kind of this misunderstood racism in this remark. I mean, there wasn't any racism in this remark, and it was misunderstood, but maybe if you understand this point about the difference between utterance meaning and utterer's meaning, it's slightly understandable. Because maybe the utterance meaning wasn't exactly the meaning that he had in mind, given the context. What's interesting in the context of this novel is that it is about the race of the professor. And the professor has, through his adult life, ever since leaving the Navy at 20 or so, represented himself as a white person. But as a matter of fact, he is, well, let's not get into issues about the one drop rule, he is, you know, black or somewhat black, but has passed for white. So that adds a kind of irony to the fact that he, and of course he knows that, but almost no one in his entourage knows that, that adds to the irony of the misunderstanding of his remark as being racist when it wasn't, even though that understanding is slightly understandable if you understand what I mean by how utterance meaning is determined. If, in fact, he had been known to be, I'm still extending the theoretical point now, if, in fact, he had been known to be a black professor, which he wasn't known to be because he was hiding that in a way, then, of course, that would have added a different feature to the context, which would have made it less likely that the audience would have attributed the racist intention to him. Since we don't expect people to be making, snotty or derogatory or rude comments about their own group. Okay, now a last complexity in this example, which I haven't mentioned so far, is that what audience are we talking about? The ones who were actually in the class when he made the remark, or the students who heard about it secondhand? Those are actually two different audiences, and they are actually having, they're actually two different contexts, and that would lead to maybe two different hypotheses of what the intended meaning was, and therefore of the utterance meaning of that utterance to those sort of two different audiences. All right, that's enough for that example. So let's get back to the your main issue, which is okay. With that distinction then in hand, what the hypothetical intentionalist says is that an artwork is like an utterance. It's a use of a, it's the construction or an presentation of a text in a context where the context is ideally fully grasped by the audience. That's like they know something about the author, about the author's other works, about the author's public persona or history, and that when they receive the text, they form hypotheses about what the text could be meaning or saying. And that might not correspond to what the author or artist actually intended to convey. So according to hypothetical intentionalism, the artist's actual intentions, even when, as a matter of fact, they're successfully realized, and I will come back to what I think that means ultimately, the artist's actual intention is not determinative or constitutive of a work's utterance meaning, that is, say, of its meaning as an artwork offered in a given communicative context. What is determinative or constitutive of a work's utterance meaning is the best hypothesis, given the text and the context, of what the text is being used to convey. So when you look at these two views, they actually suggest the same operating procedure. Form plausible hypotheses about what the text, about what the concrete author was attempting to convey, except with this difference, that when you've gotten the best hypothesis, and in at least in the form of the theory that I've defended, best means primarily means epistemically best. Let's say the one that takes the best account of the evidence that's the most plausible, given all the evidence, the text and the public aspects of the artist and the artist's corpus. And then secondarily, best in the sense of making it aesthetically best if, in fact, there's any kind of maneuvering room between alternative hypotheses. So when you've done that, you have constitutively arrived at what the work means. The actual intentionalist says that the work really means what it was actually intended to mean, where that's compatible sort of with the text and with the other kind of aspects of conventional meaning. So the issue is really is not in terms of methodology or what you do to figure out what a work means. It's your view about what's constitutive of the work meaning. And for an actual intentionalist, what's constitutive of the work meaning, at least in most cases, because they allow in some cases there is no actual author's intention, yet the work ends up having a meaning. In that case, it's because conventions and context somehow do the work by themselves. But at least in most cases, in the happy cases, what is determinative, or constitutive of a literary work's meaning, is what's successfully actually intended by the artist. For a hypothetical intentionalist, the actual intention never plays that role. It's never constitutive of what the work means. It may match what the work means in some cases, but what's constitutive is this best hypothesis, which is arrived at by trying to make the most plausible projection onto the actual artist of intended meaning, given all the, let's say, admissible evidence, the text and the public image of the artist. So what are some advantages of this view over the actual intentionalist view? These will be contested, of course, by the actual intentionalists, but let me just tick them off anyway. It looks as if it preserves, better than the actual intentionalists view, the centrality of the text in the interpretive project. That we really do have to focus on what the text can be seen to mean, at least in context. And yet it isn't, of course, a view that simply collapses into the view that work meaning is just text meaning. No, again, that's a view that no one could reasonably defend. So what it does is it preserves the notion of the artist's intention as something that we're aiming at. It just doesn't make the artist's actual intention into something that's determinative of meaning, but it's rather something that we aim at in our plausible constructions of what a work's about. So the work meaning on this view is related to author intention, but not because author intention determines it, but rather because work meaning is really our best construction or hypothesis of what author intention is. So in fact, the notion of author's intention is still playing a role. It's just not playing a role. It's playing a role in our heuristic arriving at the meaning of the work. Because works do have to be understood as the products of intentional agents. But it doesn't make the actual intention play any role in determining meaning. Okay, a second thing that looks like favors this view is that it's just more elegant, and even its opponents recognize it's more elegant because it's a single notion, it's a single rule. It's work meaning is given by, best hypothesis about author intended meaning. That's the rule. The actual intentionalist has a much more complicated story to tell. He says that what a work means is what the author intended it to mean when that intention is successfully realized, and working in connection with conventions and context. But in some cases, what the work means is not what the author intended to mean, because the author, say, didn't intend anything or had no clear intentions. And then work meaning is given by the text in connection with the operative conventions and context. So it's a kind of fundamentally disjunctive view that doesn't seem to have any great theoretical appeal as a result. At least to me, it seems very inelegant and ad hoc. And a third sort of advantage, at least prima facie advantage of the hypothetical perspective, is that it looks like preserves a certain amount of autonomy of the artwork. Not seeing the artwork as essentially a vehicle for expressing the artist's intentions, but as something to be understood on its own right. Now here, though, there's a subtlety, and let me read what I have here to try and get that across. So an advantage of the hypothetical intentionalist view about literary meaning is that it preserves a degree of autonomy. You don't want it to underwrite complete autonomy, because that would be a mistake as well. Literary works really do have to be understood as human products that are offered in a concrete historical, cultural, communicative context. But that can be insisted on without being an actual intentionist about meaning. So a certain amount of autonomy is preserved by this view. Autonomy of the artwork vis-a-vis the artist, in that what the work means or conveys, though it is indirectly what the artist ends up meaning or conveying, what the work means or conveys is never as a constitutive matter what the artist intended the work to mean or convey. It may, as a matter of fact, be the same as what the artist intended to convey, but it's never constitutively that. Let me just say two more things, I think, and then I'll stop. Here's a further distinction, which has been kind of rolling around in the wings of the various distinctions I've been offering so far. But I think if you grasp this distinction, it helps to see that maybe the conflict between these two views isn't so serious, and they really can be seen as almost comrades in arms. Okay, the distinction is this: what an author intended to mean by producing a given text in a given context. What an author intended to mean by producing a text in a given context. That's, of course, what an actual intentionalist says, determines, at least partly, in most cases, work meaning. So call that A. Okay, B is what an author succeeds in meaning by producing a text in a given context. What an author succeeds in meaning by producing a text in a given context. Call that B. Now, A and B are clearly different. What the author intended to mean, and what the author succeeds in meaning. But B, what an author succeeds in meaning, though not A, might be identified with another of the formulas that I've used so far, namely, what the author's work, the text in context, means. So you might identify what an author succeeds in meaning in producing a given text in a context with what the work means. But why is it? Why could you identify those? Why would it be reasonable to identify what an author succeeds in meaning in producing a given text in a given context and what the author's work means? The reason that you could identify them with some justice is because the author succeeds in meaning M, using big M here to mean, again, in this oversimplified way, as if there was a single thing that a novel or a film could mean. Well, let's pretend for a minute. Let's call it big M. The author succeeds in meaning M, big M, in virtue of the work's meaning M. That's how the author succeeded in meaning M. It's because he managed to make a work that means M. But it's not because the work, and it's not the reverse, that the work means M. The work has that meaning that it does, in virtue of the author succeeding in meaning M. But that's more the picture that the author intentionalist wants to advance, that the work means M because the author succeeded in meaning M. That phrase is a close relative to this idea of successfully realizing the intention to mean M. So the right way around is the first way. The author succeeds in meaning M in virtue of the work's meaning M, and not that the work means M in virtue of the author succeeding in meaning M. What an author succeeds in meaning need not be what an author intended to mean. I'm just thinking whether to trot out this point again about what's wrong with the idea of successfully realized intention as a criterion of work meaning. Well, I'll give it one more try. Although I feel like I'm sort of déjà... It's not déjà vu or déjà entendu, it's déjà parlé. Because I gave a talk on this in a seminar context earlier in the year, in the fall. So what's really wrong with this idea of appealing to successfully realize intention? Well, what is it to successfully realize an intention to mean something? Well, it's to intend to mean that, and for you to create something that actually means that. How else could you successfully realize your intention to mean something by making an artwork? To successfully realize your intention is to intend to mean something, and for the vehicle you use, the work you create, to actually mean that. But remember, the objective to these two theories of interpretation, these two and any other you might want to consider, is to explain what work meaning is. Give a rule or criterion or an analysis of work meaning. The hypothetical intentionalist does offer that. He says that what the work means is the best hypothesis about what the author actually intended. That gives you the meaning of the work. What does the actual intentionalist say? He says, well, the meaning of the work is what the author actually intended it to mean when that intention is successfully realized. But what is it for the actual intention to be successfully realized? It's for the work to end up meaning that. But you've sort of used the notion he was supposedly analyzing. And Sophisticated actual intentionalists, most sophisticated of which is probably my friend Stecker, dance around this in various ways, but I don't think they ever escape this problem. Stecker's best attempt, or at least his best smokescreen at avoiding this, is to say that it's a kind of process of mutual equilibration or mutual matching of a hypothesis about the intention and a hypothesis about the meaning. But I frankly just don't see how that gets around the basic logical problem. Let me end with one more example, again, from something I happen to be reading, which has much less literary value than The Human Stain. But it's a sort of interesting read anyway, because it's an interesting insight into the mind of this very strange character who we all, I hope, love and admire as a writer of great American songs, namely Bob Dylan. So I was reading Bob Dylan's Chronicles, which, despite all the praise on the back, is not a literary masterpiece or any other kind of masterpiece, but it is kind of intriguing, and you do learn about what his most important influences are. Not straight off, but when you read between the lines, he eventually makes it clear that, you know, Woody Guthrie, Robert Johnson, and a few others, where he got his kind of basic thrust from. But in any case, he spends altogether too much time talking about his late period, and not enough time that most of us would be interested in about his early work, his sort of great work. But he spends a lot of time talking about the songs in, I don't know, some album I think was released about 6 years ago called Something Empire, and a song called Dark Eyes. And I found the text online. I didn't remember how the melody went. I listened to a YouTube thing, but it was certainly terrible, and I don't think it has too much musical quality. But in any case, the text is sort of interesting. And what I learned from reading the Chronicles is that he wrote this song when he was staying at the Plaza Hotel on 59th Street in New York City. He came back after midnight. He went through the lobby, headed upstairs. As I stepped out of the elevator, a call girl was coming towards me in the hallway, pale yellow hair, wearing a fox coat, high-heeled shoes that could pierce your heart. She had blue circles around her eyes, black eyeliner, dark eyes. She looked like she had been beaten up and was afraid that she'd get beat up again. In her hand, a crimson purple wine in a glass. "I'm dying for a drink," she said as she passed me in the hall. She had a beautifulness. You only allow words like beautifulness to writers like Dylan. "But not for this kind of world. Poor wretch, doomed to walk this hallway for 1,000 years. Later that night, I sat at a window overlooking Central Park and wrote the song Dark Eyes." Before I read you a bit of this text, how many of you are familiar with another song called Dark Eyes, a traditional song? Well, it's actually a Russian song. It's called Archichorny. That's the real Dark Eyes, as far as I'm concerned. But in any case, apparently there's now a song by Dylan called Dark Eyes. And if you read this song, I don't have the time to read it. You get the usual set of images that are suggestive and sort of vaguely hang together, and a kind of scenario is suggested. I haven't lived with this song long enough to even give you a sense of what it's about. But you would not know that this song is about or has any connection to the sad plight of a call girl encountered in the halls of a hotel in New York City. But suppose that Dylan, in fact, intended this song to be about that, to be about his encounter with the call girl and the depressing, philosophical thoughts that incited in him. And suppose, and I'm not sure this is the case, suppose you could kind of see that in this song if you kind of read between the lines with that knowledge. Would that make it the case that this song is about the plight of a curl girl in New York City, doomed to walk the halls of the Ansonia Hotel forever? Or it's not the Ansonia, the Plaza Hotel, sorry. A very different hotel. No. And yet an actual intentionalist would say that it was. But that's what's wrong with actual intentionalism. It leads to incorrect assignments of literary meaning, and it sort of narrows the range of what artworks can read by by tying them too closely to what artists actually intend to get across rather than what they actually end up getting across. And even artists should be happier to acknowledge what they end up getting across and let go hang what they actually intended to get across. At least if what they actually get across is something that moves us and that we find interesting and want to live with. Okay, well that's enough for that. I'm sorry this is a bit scattered as lectures go, but I'd say that'd be...